Thank you. Please join me in welcoming Jonavi Harrison to our gathering. Some of you may remember Jonavi from her seva with Gauravani's group as Kindred Spirits. And we're also honored to have Sharon with us here this evening. Thanks for being here. We hope you'll come
be with us.
Oh, gosh. How's everybody doing? How are you since last week? Everything's fine? How many of you have been following along the last three or four sessions here, either live or as podcasts, where we are now officially a part of the iTunes download world?
250
downloads.
250
downloads?
How is that? Thank you.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, it's you guys with your challenging comments and questions, and this is longer than I think any one topic we've ever been on. This is third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and we've kind of grouped three or four verses together here, ending with the verse that we'll be reciting this evening, which is third chapter, verse 41, a controversial verse, if ever there was one. It's not in the handbook. The handbook we will be using later, because the Vaishnav Pranam is in the handbook, and I thought we would do that at the end of our gathering this evening. But if you have a copy of the Gita, are there any more in the box? So, all gone. Page 177. We're at a part of the Bhagavad Gita. How many of you are here for the first time? Oh, goodness, we have several new people. Well, welcome.
Welcome.
Very nice to have you with us. Thank you very much. Hi. How are you doing? What's your name?
Adolf.
Adon. Adon. Adon.
A-O-D.
Adon. Welcome. Welcome. And you are again?
Gabrielle.
And in the back?
Rachel.
Hi, welcome. And you are also new today?
Kristen.
Very nice to have you here. Thank you. Thank you. And to our podcast universe. Your name is?
Kelly.
Hi, welcome. Welcome. Nice to have you with us as well. 341 on page 177. The way we've been doing this, for those of you who may not be acquainted, is that we do approximately a verse a week from the Bhagavad Gita. So we're in our fifth year and we're only in the third chapter. And that's fine, because every verse of the Bhagavad Gita is a compact universe of knowledge and wisdom. Every Sanskrit word can be translated in a dozen different ways. So to unpack the threads within that can be very rewarding and edifying, and can go on for weeks at a time just on one verse. This particular section of the third chapter is problematic for reasons that will be obvious in a moment. But the protocol that you would find if you were in a formal environment in India would be to first recite together or responsively an invocation, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, three times, which establishes a certain mood, a certain formality for a discussion of sacred text, and also honors Bhagavan Sri Krishna, who is the speaker of the Gita. So if you would kindly repeat after me, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Now your turn.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Bhagavad Gita Chapter 3, Text 41. Let's do this one line at a time. Right? First, let's just recite it without a melody. I'll say it once, and then you're welcome to repeat. Tasmat tvam indriyanyado. Tasmat tvam indriyanyado. Niyamya bharatarshava. Niyamya bharatarshava. Niyamya bharatarshava. Niyamya bharatarshava. Papmanam prajahi yenam. Papmanam prajahi yenam. Papmanam prajahi yenam. Papmanam prajahi yenam. Gyana vigyana nashanam. Gyana vigyana nashanam. Gyana vigyana nashanam.
Gyana vigyana.
So a simple melody for reciting most verses of the Bhagavad Gita goes something like this. Tasmat tvam indriyanyado. Tasmat tvam indriyanyado. Yamya bharatarshava. Yamya bharatarshava. Appanam prajahinam. Sanskrit has multiple meanings. I'll often offer this caveat to the translation that we read in this particular edition of the Gita, which was written and commented by my spiritual master, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, whose photo you see here on the altar. And that is that Prabhupada was born in the 19th century, and some of the cultural anomalies of the world that he grew up in work their way into the commentaries and the translations. So, for example, this word, papmanam, is translated here as sin. The environment that Prabhupada grew up in was colonial India. And you had
Victorian
colonial India. And there was a very strong Christian influence and a strong conversional Christian influence. And so there are certain words that may filter into the translation here, which would have another kind of connotation. And I think part of our job is finding the proper equivalence, the appropriate equivalence in a contemporary language. So pop, which is being described here as sin or lust, may also be described as selfish action. There are two words, pap and punya. Punya means beneficial, rewarding, unselfish actions, work that is done for the good of others. And if you see that on one side of the scale and papa on the other side of the scale, then you begin to get a little bit of a sense of something other than just carnal intercourse. So there's more to the there's more depth to that term than might be conveyed in the English word sin. Right? So the translation here, therefore, O Arjuna, best of the Bharatas, in the very beginning, curb this great symbol of sin, lust, by regulating the senses and slay this destroyer of knowledge and self-realization. When I read this, I wonder how it is that any intelligent, thoughtful, sensitive person would have any response to this other than closing the book and walking away. It's a rather draconian perspective on things. And this is the fourth in a series of discussions that we've had about human sexuality. Now, it just so happens, this is, it's not a preoccupation, I promise you this. We're looking at it because it is so central to human nature, and yet it is so rarely discussed within a yoga environment. Yoga culture seems to have somehow sidestepped one of the most complex dimensions of human nature, and yet you cannot divorce yoga from human nature. They are of a piece. So we're taking our time to discuss this, and it's a candid conversation, and if, you know, we don't get that graphic, but we do talk candidly, and this particular fourth and final topic is about relationships. So in the previous sessions, we've talked about human sexuality from, first of all, the perspective of the Gita, that our yearning, our inclination toward pleasure and joy is an expression of the qualities of the soul. We seek joy and satisfaction and happiness and pleasure because the soul is by nature Sat-Chit-Ananda. That is a quality that is inherent to all life. When that Sat-Chit-Ananda soul comes into a material form, the original joy of the soul becomes covered over. We still want that. We still seek that original nature. But because we have now become somewhat oblivious to our true spiritual self, we find it in the world that we can perceive. So it comes through the senses, the body and the mind. So the yoga process is to reawaken knowledge of ourselves as true spiritual beings and therefore find the ultimate satisfaction that comes from the joy of the soul. So we looked at initially from the Gita perspective. We also saw this from a psychological and biological perspective, that the body rewards those behavior patterns that are conducive to protecting life. Eating tastes good because that is a behavior that is conducive to preserving and protecting life. Sex feels good because that is a behavior that is conducive to perpetuating the species and keeping life alive. So we looked at the work of certain researchers who have conducted experiments on what are called the reward pathways of the brain and how certain behavior literally creates in this little pharmacy that you've got going up here in the brain, dopamines and other kinds of chemicals that feel good as they course through the bloodstream. And we looked at the difference between that kind of a physical pleasurable sensation and sustained joy. There are two things in Sanskrit. There's shreya and preya. Preya means the immediate gratification. Something that you see, you want it, you go after it, you get it. And they have the satisfaction of having done that. Shreya means the long-term benefit, the greater benefit that may require sacrifice. Something that is beneficial for me, but which requires some self-control, some self-restraint. So you postpone immediate gratification to achieve some greater good. Right? You go to college, you get an education. Theoretically, you're postponing going out and earning money. You are now spending money, theoretically, because that will put you in a better position in the long term to have a successful career. You postpone sensual gratification in order to go through a training period. That's called brahmacharya. In the traditional Indian system, there are stages called the varnas and ashramas. And a young person, boy or girl, will, in early life, in the traditional schools of Indian thought, go through a certain period of education and abstinence and discipline, learning discipline. You know, again, theoretically, that's what the military is supposed to do. It's supposed to give you a certain sense of discipline in life. It has become distorted. But the idea of early life being dedicated to a learning of to appreciate and enjoy discipline is because there is a shreya, there's a long-term benefit to be gained from doing so. So we've looked at this from a number of perspectives. We've also looked at this from a psychological perspective. Some of the current schools of psychology would say that in the act of sex, there is an attempt to compensate for our fear of death. We look specifically at the work of... now I'm drawing a blank. The author of... Fear. Huh?
Freud?
No, not Freud.
Masters and Johnson?
No, it'll come to me in a minute. We looked at a few different
Freud's
books.
Right.
No, but you're on the right track there. No, it'll come to me. It's in my notes somewhere, but I'd rather not interrupt the flow to look for the name right now. It'll come to mind. That we are vulnerable because the body is temporary and perishable. And so we seek ways to protect ourselves. And by joining with another, there is a sense of comfort, of completeness, of security that subconsciously sends a signal that says, by playing with you and letting you play with me, I can achieve some of the comfort, reassurance, and sense of self-worth that we may have missed growing up, that we may not have received in childhood. So there are kinds of compensations that come with that human sexual energy.
Also,
yeah.
Your orgasmic experience is the experience of death, or the experience of deep sleep, or the experience in dhyan, where you're free of thought, you're free of desire. Yeah. It may last just a second or so, but it's still, it's that experience of being free.
So therefore, it gives that sense of having achieved a moving away from all of the shackles of life before that moment. So, yeah. So, from these many different lenses, we can look at human sexuality and begin to get some perception of the difference between the temporary sensation of pleasure, which takes place in a very, very discrete zone. I think we might have talked about this. I don't know about you guys, but it takes me about 10 minutes to get my shower temperature just right. You know, 1 degree this way or 1 degree that way, and it's not so enjoyable. Right? Or food. Too much of one spice in a dish, and it's ruined. You can't enjoy it anymore. So the pleasure zone is actually a quite limited span on the spectrum. Right? It also is a function of age. The sexual proclivity is there. It does not emerge in a young child. It comes at puberty. So there's a reason for that, because those are the childbearing years. That's when you need that body chemistry most. And then the chemicals begin to dissipate. And by the time you reach a certain age, you no longer have those same energies because you don't need them. The body doesn't create those chemicals anymore. So you don't need the same kind of impetus to sexual engagement. That narrow band of pleasure is quite different from the description of Ananda, the description of the ecstasy of those great yogis who have achieved full self-awareness and who live in a very steady state of pleasure. That pleasure is quite different from the pleasure of the body. But, and here's the big but, I've been reading and reading this verse for years, and I've been trying to figure out why such a heavy hand. Why such a heavy hand here? Right. Now, we talked about this also, that Arjuna is not a kindergarten student. There's no need for Krishna to be talking to him as though he were a child. Control your lust. You know? These are two elevated beings who are talking about something much deeper than that. What is that deeper subject that they're talking about? That's where we need to deepen the conversation here. So I've been asking myself, why is it that sex is being described in this one particular translation of this one verse as the destroyer of knowledge and self-realization? It couldn't possibly be from the pleasure that you experience. That pleasure feels so natural. It is, after all, a product of the body. It's not some laboratory-induced aberration. It's something that is endemic to all life forms. all living beings have this capacity to one extent or another. So why is it being described in such draconian language? And the more I thought about it, the more it occurred to me that what's being described here is not the pleasure of sex as some kind of an enemy, but the concomitant mindset that reinforces the identification with the body. The pleasure of sex is so intense that it will reinforce, unless you are on a very high level of self-awareness, that tendency to think, this is me. I'm really enjoying this. So what is the destroyer of knowledge? It's that ahankara mentality that I am the body and that I am now enjoying this sexual experience. So it's not sex per se, it's not pleasure per se, but it is the risk of reinforcing this illusory sense that I am the one enjoying when really it's the interaction of the senses and their objects. Okay? And the reason why that came to mind is that if you take this verse in context, which you always must do, if you are going to read Bhagavad Gita, you cannot take a verse out of context. It is always a function of what's come before in the discussion, what's coming after in the discussion, the circumstances around Krishna and Arjuna at that moment. Remember always that these are two friends who love each other dearly. They've known each other from childhood. Arjuna is married to Krishna's sister. They're family. They know each other. Time and again throughout the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, why am I giving you my deepest secrets? It's because I love you. It's because you're my friend. I can trust you. You're not going to betray me. You don't reveal your mind to just anybody. You don't tell your most sensitive thoughts to someone whom you are not sure can honor that trust. Someone who's going to betray you or use that knowledge against you, why would you reveal your heart to that person? So even though Arjuna was not a great Sanskritist, he wasn't a scholar, he was a married guy in the military. Krishna says to him, you are the worthy recipient because I love you, we are friends, I trust you, you love me, take this from me. I want to help you now in your direst moment, in your moment of greatest need. Right? So what is the papmanam of Arjuna here at this moment? What is it that he's going through? Someone can offer a suggestion here. What is Arjuna going through that would be described as this great enemy of self-knowledge? What is it that he's experiencing here that Krishna is actually addressing? He's not talking about, you know, stop sleeping around. I mean, that's not what this is. Let's go inside what's happening here. What is he saying to Arjuna? Remember the situation. There's a battle about to take place. Fear of death? Possibly. From what? What would that come from? What would the fear of death originate in? Take that a step further, Michael. Where does it come from? Why would you fear death? What self do you preserve from death? Okay, now we're getting there.
Identification with the body,
with the circumstances of this one moment in time, which is what Arjuna was doing. Arjuna was taking the conditions around him so seriously that he was giving up the one thing that he most needed to do, which is, if that doesn't ring any bells for you, nothing will. we run from the one thing that we know we have to do because we're afraid of what? Can't do it. I'm going to look foolish. I'm going to be embarrassed. It's going to be my ruination. I'm going to have to do something that's too painful for me to do.
Like saving face.
Saving face. Okay. How will the world perceive me? Arjuna even uses those words. He says, how can I possibly hold my head up after this if I engage in this battle and kill these worthy soldiers, leaders of the society, my own grandfather Bhishma? My own teacher, my guru is here. Dronacharya was on the other side of that battlefield. How can you slay your own guru? So I'd say, I can't, I don't want to do this. And so Krishna is telling him, Don't be foolish. You think by going away that you're going to leave your problems behind. They're going to follow you wherever you go.
They've been in hiding for 10 years.
Huh?
They were in hiding for 10 years. So got tracked down.
Yeah, you can't run. You can run, but you cannot hide, I guess is the message there, right? Certainly not from your own karma, from the very thing that you have to confront. So let's just make sure that we deepen our... Don't close the book and run away. When you come across a passage, either in a translation or in a commentary, that really makes you want to just hurl that book across the room, note the page down, bring it to discussion, and we'll talk about it. Okay. All right, so I don't want to go into too much elaboration, because this is, I think, if any subject warrants an open dialogue, this one does. So I'm going to stop there. Just one thought before we get into discussion here. According to the Vedic texts describe that when you engage in sex, the sex act generates what are known as nadis. The sex act generates nadis. Attachments, knots. It's literally like a knot. Right? When you get married and they say you tie the knot. So these attachments that develop are very, very hard to unravel. They take many years to unravel. Which is one reason why remaining faithful to a partner is such a valuable asset.
So you only have one big knot.
They have one big knot. Instead of
so many.
A salad of knots. Having all of that energy focused in one place allows you to grow together with another person. And that becomes part of the spiritual journey. Which is why later in the Gita, Krishna says, I am sex which is not opposed to Dharma. Which to my mind is the most overlooked verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Nobody wants to talk about it, how God can be sex. What he's saying is, I am that sex which is part of that larger relationship. That larger relationship where you are moving forward together with another human being. And that becomes part of that. So I'm sorry if this class, you came to class thinking, oh goody, we're going to talk about sexual relation. I didn't want to mislead anyone into thinking that. That's outside the realm, I think, of our discussion tonight, except maybe to say one thing, and that if you're really not feeling confident about your sexual life, ask questions. Ask questions.
Joshua, do you think that we were talking in the cafe a little bit about when you read a translation, you must always take into consideration the time that the translator lived, and you mentioned that at the beginning of the session. And I mean, we have now many ways to, we have birth control methods that weren't always available.
Right, birth control came on the market in 1963.
Right. I mean, sex can lead to other entanglements besides the one night, the one moment of having intimate experience with another. And then all of a sudden you find yourself with a house full of kids you have to feed. And that means you have to go get a job. And then you have to work all day. You might have to have two jobs when you're going to do your sadhana. And so it kind of one thing leads to the next. And it can take one away from their original plan when they incarnate, going to get it this time. I'm going to get free of samsara. I'm going to break the cycle.
Yeah.
And then they're seduced back into it. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon they have a wife and kids to support and all kinds of responsibilities.
Yeah, it begins to make sannyas look quite appealing.
Yes!
Yes, it does. The idea of being free of obligations, free of responsibilities, having time to pursue your spiritual life. There are a lot of reasons why that kind of solo path might be appealing to people. Here's what's interesting. If you look at the history of the sannyas order, as you know, most sannyasis,
as you know,
were married people.
The rishis were all married.
They were married. So it's not that, you know, we do tend to kind of glorify, you know, the saffron robes and the, you know, those great souls who have given all that up, and there's a reason why we do that. But if you look at it, there's a gradual natural retirement from material activity and from a worldly life. And the notice given in the Bhagavad Gita is, if you are feeling that in yourself, don't artificially renounce it. I don't know about you guys, but I know a lot of people who took to that path, that celibate path, the sannyasi path, and they just couldn't do it. And they fell away. They weren't ready for it. I think there is the appeal of what that is was greater than the common sense that, am I ready for that? Mm-hmm. So allow that to be expressed if that energy is there. In a wholesome way, in a reasoned way, that becomes part of, if you will, the full menu of spiritual life.
But Joshua, just when what you had said previous, I mean, one of the reoccurring messages in the Gita is, do what you do, but remember me.
Yeah.
So don't change. You don't have to give up your job, your situation. Just remember me. Mm-hmm. But what you had reminded us all is it's very difficult for most people to remember God at the height of orgasm or when they're engaged previous to that event. Mm-hmm. That is, they revert to me. I am having this experience. Mm-hmm. But when he talks of being able to control the indriyas, to have that kind of heightened state of awareness on that level of sense, and we infuse it with God, remembrance of God, that was what the rishis accomplished. That is...
Yeah.
That ability to, you know, like Groucho Marx, he likes his cigar, but he took it out once in a while. We know how to control.
Did you make that up?
No, that's very good. It's Groucho Marx.
It's very funny. Yeah, the system, the culture is that if you're going to have intercourse,
you know how to do it.
You know how to do it, and there
not
was even
like using the woman as a bucket to dump into.
No. Yeah. Well, That's a very painful admission that our culture has placed women on such an object level. But in the culture, at least, when a husband and wife, we won't talk about other kinds of partnerships, but specifically a husband and wife who are looking to have a child, they would make an announcement that the astrological signs are appropriate. We are going to have sex now to have a child. It was something that was announced. It wasn't hidden. It wasn't embarrassing. It wasn't, you know, something. It was glorious. It was noble, you know, that this was something that was going to be undertaken. Now, that's the Orthodox tradition. I don't know too many people, actually, who have done that. But it was never seen as somehow outside the realm of a whole healthy spiritual life. It always had a place. So, what do you think, guys? Any questions? Does this was just meant as a kind of conversation starter, right? I really wanted you to. I'd like you to suggest. Oh yeah. You know. Yes. And it's a little warm in here. Could we open the door maybe for a couple of minutes? It's the conversation, is it? Yeah. Yes, tomorrow. Now we're really getting provocative.
My question was, maybe this is just a semantic question, but it's he wasn't saying that sex was the sin, but or whatever you want to call it, but that lust, the actual craving, was the problem. And I thought that, you know, that was interesting because the idea of, you know, cravings and dislikes is discussed in the yogic context as something that takes us away from our true self. And so that it's not the act itself, but perhaps the addiction to wanting or
yes, yes, good point. And there was a verse just earlier, I believe, in this chapter where Krishna was describing for Arjuna that you need to become somewhat equipoised both toward attachment and toward detachment. Meaning that if that craving is there, to deny it could be more harmful than to manage it effectively. So he's not saying, you know, renounce, give it up. He's saying acknowledge it, be honest about it, so that you can know how to deal with it effectively. There may be a handful of people in every generation, a handful, capable of a true celibate, non-sexually active path. It's not a large part of a generation. It's a small group of people who are capable of doing it. For the rest of us, ordinary type folk, it's important to acknowledge where we are on our spiritual path and then to be able to manage that efficiently. And that's what the Gita is looking to do. I don't think the Gita is recommending that you move away from it just arbitrarily, but acknowledging it, knowing how to deal with it properly, which can mean focusing first on the larger relationship. Going back to our topic for the evening here. It's the relationship that matters. I don't know about you, but I know a number of people who have neglected their relationship with their partner because the thinking was, that's material, and I want to be spiritual. And in some instances, that's what's needed. There's no generalization here that it's always one way or the other way. But in some instances, I'm thinking of some people, that's the opportunity that they had to enhance their spiritual life, and they've moved away from it. Rather than moving away, why not try going deeper inside it and finding God in the details? Maybe there's something that's meant to happen there that you haven't tried yet.
That's what you're saying is that for many people, the relationship with a sexual relationship is challenging for them to use that relationship to further their sadhana, to find God. But as Kumar said, I think it is the lust that is the issue. When you are lusting, you are no longer seeing your partner as a divine being and a helpmate for you to find God. You're seeing your partner as someone to service you, as the ego-bound individual. And that is what will take you away from self-realization.
Not many times agree with both of you. So much people's self-image nowadays is powerfully socially conditioned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a very strong driver.
Yeah, it's a good point. We're at a disadvantage in this culture. This is not a culture that rewards deep thought and sensual control. That's not New York. In the spiritual cultures, the wisdom cultures, that moving inside the relationship is such a beautiful thing. It's such a wonderful thing because it is an opportunity, as Sharon was pointing to demonstrate putting someone else's interest before your own. That's devotion. Ultimately, that attitude informs our relationship with God, with Krishna. So here in this arena, we have the opportunity to exercise those skills of devotion which inform our spiritual life. So the beauty of a partnership is that you, in a sense, you're practicing your partnership with God.
Remember me.
Yeah.
Krishna says, remember me. And it's all about the intention, an action in and of itself. The result of that action is according to the intention in the mind and heart of the person. So you could have sex with someone, and your intention could be to selfishly get something for yourself, or even humiliate or harm that other, and we would call that rape. And that same action could be done to elevate the other, to feel the presence of God, to remember God, and we'll call that making love. It's the same action, but the intention within will determine the result of that action.
It's an extremely important point. Intent determines the difference between something being karma, vikarma, or akarma.
Yes.
Between an action being an anchor that embeds you more in...
Or frees you.
The same thing, two people in the same action. One person is becoming more entangled and the other is becoming liberated because of intent. Even in law, intent is critical.
Right.
The same action...
Premeditated murder.
Yeah.
Heavier crime.
Yeah. Yes, Julia.
It occurred to me that when you hear exactly like you said earlier of somebody who was in a relationship and decided, you know, that's not spiritual, I'm going to go do that. It's almost like lust for the spiritual, you know, it's the image of whatever that is. It's like still maybe lust in the same definition.
Yeah, you can be lusty after anything, including your own spiritual life. When you objectify spiritual life in such a way that it becomes another acquisition, then it can be as much of a deterrent to your own true spiritual interest as any material pursuit.
Right, and you close it off to what other people
and other family do. And we were talking about that earlier. There is a tendency, and there's almost even a real appeal to making your spiritual life the comfortable alternative to your material life. I don't like this, so let me go there. And that there then becomes some kind of other facet of the American dream. Some projection of a comfortable place to be. And really, discomfort can be so rewarding. Living on that edge where you're constantly looking for the opportunity to make your contribution. It's a very different thing from looking for a comfortable place to be. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was my teacher's grand guru, used to say that when I get to do something difficult for Krishna, that's my joy. The more difficult it is, the more rewarding it is. So, yeah. Good. Come on, let me hear from some others. Other thoughts. I'm sure this must be making you think of something. Yeah, share.
I was having a conversation
Thank you.
I think the question was, you were having, Cher was having a discussion with a friend about multiple partners, and how does having... How does having multiple partners...
Is that possible to have multiple partners and have service for Chris Robinson?
Wow. Well, my mind automatically is looking for some kind of cute, facetious answer for that, and I'm not going to do that. I like what Sharon just said about, you know, Krishna can do that.
Yeah.
He can have multiple partners. Right. Wait until you're Krishna, then come back and we'll talk. Are you talking about multiple physical sexual partners?
Yes.
No, I have to qualify that because, you know, you'll hear from advanced spiritual types who are celibate that they do feel an intimacy with their community. You know, that they have that sense of, in a way, metaphorically, multiple partners because they're sharing their lives with so many people. And so many people trust their lives to such a person. And there is such a great reward in that. I mean, you can live without genital sex. I'm not sure we can live very long without intimacy. I don't think we can live very long without that sense of really sharing our hearts with others. That's a very lonely life if you have no one to do that with. And when you're in that kind of position, then the genital sex, the physical sex, can become more important because it's a displacement of that greater need for the intimacy of souls, fellow seekers on the spiritual path. So far, look, in the Vedic culture, and in many traditional cultures, many religious nations, many formal cultures, there is place for polygamy. The explanation that has usually been offered for that when it comes to the kings in India, for example, in India's history, who had many wives, is that if you can do it, if you can afford it, and there are more women often in some instances who are than men, and so to kind of balance the scales, if, you know, I only know one person who's managing to do that successfully. One person I know. Everyone else is failing miserably. So I don't know. The odds aren't great. That's all I can tell you. It's really complicating things way past logical limits. So I maybe for somebody it can work. I do the math. I don't see how it computes. You know, just keeping the calendar straight. Look, this isn't to put anybody down, and particularly if you don't know somebody, how can you possibly even form an impression of them? So I don't know the circumstances there, but you're asking, and the only reaction I can think is that more often than not, whether it's with one person at a time or 10 people at a time, that kind of need for sexual engagement usually has its roots in some kind of gap in the healthy development of a person's earlier life. Ideally, you get a certain degree of self-confidence, self-worth, and a impetus to offer respect to others and engage in the work of the world from parents who are themselves spiritually advanced and can impart that knowledge to a child. That ain't the time we're living in now. It's tragic how many children are growing up without that kind of inspiration in their life and later may seek to balance the missing elements by having sex with as many people as possible. If I don't feel very good about myself, if I don't feel that anybody is accepting of me, then maybe the only way I can get that feeling is by experiencing other people responding to me, and then the more people I can get to respond to me, the more that missing sense of self-worth is gratified. But that's very different. That's not the kind of sex Krishna describes later when he says, I am sex that is not opposed to Dharma. Bravado.
Yeah.
Meaning, look at me, I am the fulfillment of the American dream. I am the American idol. Sure.
I'm a man's man.
I'm a man's man. Yeah, look.
It's an illusion.
These, again, regretfully, we're living in a culture that does not reward self-control, abstinence, respect for life in all its forms, minimizing material needs. Why? Because the system thrives on debt. Capitalist culture lives on you spending money and buying things. And the only reason for buying all those things is if somehow I convince you that you actually need them. Welcome to America. Yeah.
So for a practical point of a person on a spiritual path, take your time, dating, make sure you get to know yourself, and be devotional to the person before you get into the physical aspects of intimacy. Is the moral of
It may be one of the great myths of our time that I'll never know if I'm right for this person until I sleep with this person. That's probably one of the great myths of contemporary American culture. Right. How am I going to know if I don't sleep with them? What's that? I missed the punchline. What did you say? Huh? A trip to IKEA. That's right. Yes, yes. That's right. Yeah, yeah. And the latest, you know, and to do that you have to adorn yourself properly and everything else. Some other thoughts or feedback, and I'm glad we can keep a sense of humor about all this. Yeah.
Going back to somebody, one of you were commenting on how a lot of people, especially homeowners or post-homers, they have already a life very complex life and they cannot do their song. You know what I mean? But also it's like, well, my personal situation, I have a lot of responsibilities. I'm not a householder, but I have a lot of responsibilities. But then that's my dharma. You know, that's my path. That's what I was supposed to do in this life. And how does the sadhana can become also like your practice throughout your dharma and what you do every day?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, it goes back to the quote from the Gita that Sharon gave us where Krishna says, whatever you do, whatever you offer in charity, whatever you eat, whatever you give away, any action that you perform, do that as an offering to me. Other verses where Krishna says, one who sees everyone in me and me in everyone is never lost to me.
And this is why japa.
Yes, yeah, you're reading my thought. Yeah, the chanting.
It's sadhana for everyone. How is someone supposed to, you can always chant the name of God when you're picking the kids up from school or going to the grocery store, anything.
Very practical.
Even having sex.
Yes. Hare Krishna. Yes. Hare Bol. There's a place later in the Bhagavad Gita, it may be the 18th chapter, where Krishna says that since the beginning of time, the sages, before initiating any action, would chant the phrase Om Tat Sat. There was always that sense of whatever it is you're doing, whatever you're doing, let me make this an offering. Let me infuse in this that sense of I am an eternal lover of God. And let me make this part of that. It's an extraordinary thing, and it can be done just with a simple mantra, just reminding yourself, which is why chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram. You can do that anywhere, anytime. Wonderful to start the day like that. Just a few minutes, if that's all you can spend. But every day, start your day right, you know. And then everything from there on will fall into that place. And, well, of course, you have a particular situation because you're going back home And you're going to be picking up where you left off as the spiritual example for your students. So you have a particular responsibility there to be a good example. But anyone can take any activity. I cannot think of anything that is so, that nothing is devoid of contact with the divine. Our job is to find it. It's to find that connection. And I think that can save a lot of relationships. And I'm saying, well, what has this got to do with my spiritual life? All I get is suras, you know, which is a Bengali word. All I get out of this is, you know, pains and headaches. And, you know, well, have you looked at it carefully enough? You know, have you really sought to find the essence of that situation? Which is why coming here is so important. If this final of four classes on human sexuality and spiritual life is about relationships, then boy, do we owe a big vote of thanks to Sharon and David. Because we have a place to do that. I mean, I cannot tell you how this has changed my life. Having a place to come and have this kind of a relationship with you all. Yeah, I thank my lucky stars for it.
I think I'm blessed to be here.
Yeah.
First off, I'm looking for peace after everything is done. I said, it's all stirring inside. When you are one with yourself, you know, you don't have to think about what you like in bed. You already know. You're a saint. You have no attachments. You're a saint. You're inside of it. Both of you.
Rodney, you have to promise me something, that one day you're going to write a book.
It's,
are you writing a book? Thank you. Because your comments are so insightful, and they're witty, and they're amazing. I really have to thank you for them. It's wonderful having you here in the class. Thank you so much. It's beautiful. Any other thoughts or comments? We have a little bit of time left, so we can continue on with our discussion here.
I just have a thought. I don't know how exactly it pertains to everything, but I just recently got married 1 year ago.
Oh, congratulations.
And right, actually, before I got married, I came across a person, a man, and I felt an instant connection. Like, wow, this person and I feel like we know each other already. Mm-hmm. But I had this sense of liberation because I had already made my choice to marry this other person who I also have a connection with. And I realized that I now have the freedom to feel, like, love or, I guess, respect or amazement by other souls or people I come across, but I don't have to worry about where is this going to go, or, you know, are we going to have sex, or, you know, that kind of thing. So I don't know where that exactly fits in, but I think that it's part of what you were saying about lust being distracting, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that there's always these deep connections we have with people mm-hmm. that I think are really important somehow. I don't know why. I mean, I'm not sure why they're important, but I think they are. You get inspired by other people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. I'm thinking about what you just said, where there's so much in there. There's one thing that I heard you say is that having a partner frees you up to explore relationships with other people because you're not in that same space of uncertainty about where this is going to go.
Right.
Did I understand that
yes.
part correctly? Okay. Another part of what you were saying was that we seem to have so many relationships with so many people that deserve to be explored. Did I get that part
yes.
right as well?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Then what do you do if you don't have a partner? I would love to have a partner and I don't have a partner. What should I do?
Internet.
Is there a yogimatch.com?
What is it called? I don't know.
Ohmmatch.com.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know either.
Sure, there is such a... Well, I guess it just makes it easier in that one way, but you should be able to find it in other ways too, right?
Yeah. This came up, I think, was it last week? Somewhere recently it came up that there is something magical about the way the world works. That if you're too covetous of something, it seems to move farther away. And that very often, if you focus on what's really important, namely your own spiritual development, your own inner work, your inner life, that somehow that becomes so beautiful and so attractive that you might then be in a position to meet someone who would be attracted to you who might not otherwise see that in you. So you might not have to work so hard at it. There's something to that, and I don't think I can quote chapter and verse for you. That's not in the Bhagavad Gita. It just seems to be something that from practical experience I've seen works. And I can also tell you this from my own experience, that if you look for a partnership out of need, you are more likely to choose a wrong partner, or a partner who would not be as healthy for you in a relationship. Because once you recognize that it was the need that brought us together, what else is there? Now, it doesn't mean that from such a situation a healthy partnership cannot be developed, but it generally takes a lot longer because you've got so much other stuff that you have to get through first. So I think the bottom line would be charity begins at home, love begins at home, relationships begin at home. First, have a relationship with your own true self. If we can't have that relationship with our own eternal self and with Krishna, what can we expect of relationships with others? So let that be a focus. I think that might be one very good one. Yes?
I think last week you were saying that relationships also end, marriages end, and you were talking about your friend's personal experiences, and I think that I believe you might take away from that is that the ultimate relationship is with God and with yourself. Was that right?
Sounds pretty good to me. Yes, knowing that all other relationships ultimately are doomed to end because that's the nature of this world, that everything comes to a conclusion at some time. And what Krishna keeps telling Arjuna and through Arjuna all of us time and time and time again is, would you at least have a relationship with me? Would you allow me to be your partner in life? And if you do that, I'm really here to help. I'd like to help. You know, I will, the particular verse Krishna says, I will preserve what you have and I will provide what you need. I will help protect what you have and I will help provide what you need. Here's the glitch in all of this lovely poetry. We can't see him. You know, the Gita is asking us to develop a relationship with somebody who's invisible to us right now. And then you get to that point where, I'll never forget, it was that first year we were doing the Gita series. So I was talking about developing a relationship with Krishna. A hand went up in the back of the room. This lovely young guy who I haven't seen in a while now said, "Hey man, you know, this is really beginning to sound like religion." You know, and I just came here for a stretch, you know, and that was it. I never saw him again. He didn't come. And it's a fact. You know, there is a point where the Bhagavad Gita is a straight-up bhakti text. It's a devotional text. Yes, it's going to sound religious. Krishna is the supreme person, and he's saying, love me and let me love you. That kind of sounds like religion. But going back to that discussion about seeing God in two dimensions and God is an infinite number of dimensions, that's the Krishna who's talking to us. Not the God of institutionalized religion, but the God of potentials. The supreme person of possibilities, of unfolding, unpredictable, ecstatic experience. That's interesting. That's worth looking into.
Who is Krishna?
He is the greatest friend. He is the greatest source of wisdom. He is your lover, your partner in life. He is the voice within our hearts, speaking to us, reminding us that you really don't want to do that, and maybe that would be a better thing to do. Who is there not judging us, but loving us and encouraging us, providing opportunities for our growth. Who is Krishna? He is the most pure and attractive in any category. Read 10th chapter, Bhagavad Gita. I am the light of the sun and the moon. I am the taste in water. I am flower-bearing spring. I am the Himalayan mountains and the Ganges River. I am sharks and the ability in all people. I am victory.
Grantor of liberation. Yeah. Grantor of devotion.
Yes. And Krishna is also the name Krishna. So who is Krishna? Krishna is the mantra Krishna, the name Krishna. And always with us in that form. So maybe, unless you have other questions, we can chant for a little more. Would you like to chant? Would you lead us in some more chanting? Thank you.
We ask... Gaurabhani and I have a friend who's a very great chanter, kirtan leader. Somebody said to him, "Have you ever seen Krishna when you lead kirtan? Because you do it so much, you must have had at some point a vision." And he said, "I do see him, but I'm not seeing with my eyes. You see with your ears when you chant." So I thought that was really wonderful thought.
Thank you. it's always a pleasure having you with us. Thank
you.
It's
my pleasure to have you in my life, Josh. Please stay in my life.
Back at you, kid. And thank you all as well for your wonderful insights and comments and questions. And yes, Michael.
Donations are accepted for the food, the prasad, the podcast.
By the way, just as by way of disclosure, accountability, and Sarbanes-Oxley regulations, we get on the average something like $30 to $60 a week, and we put those funds aside for the treats that Cher and others kindly prepare and bring and purchase for us. We also have a little money left over that we will sometimes spend on our quarterly, I guess they are, potluck dinners, something like that, every few months.
Quarterly
dinners, and other programs like that, if you're purchasing books or whatever it may be. So thank you for whatever you can afford. And mostly thank you for your company, which is a real gift. Hare Krishna, thank you so much. See you all again next week. And what have we got here this week, Cher?
Well, we have tangerines. Dates and almond treats, as well as a cashew and pumpkin spice candy.
Goodness gracious, that's a veritable feast. Thank you again so much. Okay, see you all next week. Thank you.